This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from the 6th of May. It is a Friday. Going to kick off with Serena's news quiz, which we always enjoy, then jumping into some of the big stories. Now, interest rates rising across the world this week. India, United States, and also the United Kingdom. Going to get the thoughts of Henry Fawn of the real estate company Knight Frank. What do rising interest rates, coupled with a falling British pound, mean for UAE investors buying British real estate? Then we're going to be talking about oil. Matt Stanley of Star Fuels. Big OPEC meeting yesterday. I say big OPEC meeting. Very, very slow OPEC meeting yesterday. 13 minutes, that was it. They didn't do much. Matt says, though, we could have $150 a barrel by July of this year. And finally, talking about the real estate industry, it's kind of real estate, it's the hotel industry. Tim Corden of Radisson Hotel Group on Eid al-Fitr staycations.
Serena Kelly.
That's the Monopoly music. We've been waiting a long time to say this, Brandy Scott. An awfully long time.
Years.
But you said the words. Serena Kelly.
It's wrong.
It's happened.
I'm not.
Remember the date, Friday, May the 6th, 2022.
Where were you? Where were
JFK moment.
I know.
You're so wrong, Serena Kelly.
How am I wrong?
Monopoly.
Yes.
I was talking about an hour ago. We were talking about parking in the UAE and when you got to pay for it this
tomorrow,
weekend.
Yes.
So tomorrow, fine. There's been free parking so far, but tomorrow that ends. Fine, okay. And I raised the question, what is the point of free parking in Monopoly? And Serena Kelly jumped in and just recap.
So basically any money that you provide to the game, such as, you know, putting the 50 note in when you can't get out of jail because you haven't been able to do your run of three doubles or whatever, you pay to get out of jail. So the money that goes in the middle for anything like that and cards from community and everything, you, when you land on free parking, you can collect said money from the middle. And?
No.
What do you mean no?
No.
That is not a rule.
That is how we play in the Kelly's household.
That doesn't make it a rule.
It is a rule, but it's like, I'm sorry.
There's lots of things we do in our households.
Okay, so go on, explain.
Mohammed has written in, Mohammed Maladi, good morning. The free parking rule isn't actually a rule. It is a house rule many people use, but it's not an official Hasbro rule. And I'm looking at the official Hasbro rules on Hasbro.com. If you have to pay income tax, you pay your $200 to the bank, or you may pay 10% of your total worth to the bank, but the money goes to the bank. This is the Hasbro rule on free parking. A player landing on this place does not receive any money, property, or reward of any kind. This is just a free resting place. Now, Hasbro did acknowledge some time ago that a number of people have various house rules that they've invented, like the Kellys.
Yes.
Okay. Made up.
No, but I agree with Mohammed. It is true. It is this, but that is the standard of how people play Monopoly.
No, it's not.
It is.
You made it up.
No, I haven't, because most households play by this rule.
Well, it's not the rule. The money goes to the bank. Okay? It doesn't go in the middle of the board, and you do not get it if you land on free parking. Okay. Hasbro did acknowledge that the number of house rules, for another one, a popular one, is you can't collect rent when you're in jail.
That's right.
No,
yes.
No, it's not right. You can.
I know, but like people do this though. They
that
tweak.
That doesn't make it right.
There's a lot of things that
people
aren't right.
People reverse here on motorways to take a turn off their mist. It doesn't mean it's a road rule.
But this is the whole point of Monopoly. You tweak these things to suit that work for
no,
your.
You okay. Don't.
You know how long Monopoly, you know the game can be very, very long. Don't shake your heads at me. Right, you know how long the game of Monopoly can be. To speed things up, people will normally, sometimes in the first round, give you a card to start you off.
Also not a rule.
Randomly, exactly. It is not a rule, but this is just household rules. And there's nothing wrong with doing that with Monopoly. But I'm giving you the option. Who wouldn't want to collect money on free parking?
makes the game longer.
No, it doesn't.
No, it does.
It gives you, when you're going about to go bankrupt, and oh, look, I've just made an extra couple of hundred
well, exactly.
from landing
so it makes
on free
the game
parking.
Longer because you, yeah.
Right.
You don't go bankrupt.
Do you know what? You play your way, I'll play mine.
No. You don't get to choose.
Yes.
It's the rule. Hasbro gets to choose.
No, sorry.
Hasbro gets to choose, not you.
I've given them enough of my money throughout my life that I'm allowed to choose how I play Monopoly. Okay? And I'm not wrong.
You're so wrong.
Muhammad's right. And yes, I'm technically sort of right, but I'm not wrong. I'm not wrong.
Well, it is that time of week when we find out who is right and who's wrong. Is it not?
Yes, it is. It's quiz time. So basically, Friday, end of the week. It's a nice way to round out all the important stories that we've covered throughout the week. And of course, we pit Brandy and Richard against one another. And you need buzzers. Now, Brandy, you've been away for this. There was a slight intervention from the powers that be above. They wanted your buzzers amended. So could you please play your buzzer? That will be your buzzer for the duration of the quiz.
Was there a problem with some of the content of the previous
buzzers?
We can
go into this later, but okay. Apparently, yes, there was a bit of, shall I say, creative difference. Can you play Richard's buzzer for me, please? Now, because Richard is sitting in a place that he can't actually play his audio, he gets...
The bell.
Right. Okay. And you are playing for a prize today.
Wow.
All right. So, yeah, no money spared on this one. And, right, are we...
So that money you've taken out of free parking.
Yes,
illegally,
from free parking,
it?
From Monopoly. Yes. Yeah, thank you very much.
What's the prize?
You'll see at the end of, well, you know, because so you're playing for just, yeah.
What's behind door number one?
Right. And you need to put up the fader for...
It's up.
Let's go.
All right. Question number one. When it comes to travel, the refurbishment of Dubai International's northern runway starts on Monday, May 9th.
Can I just point out, I've only been here for 2 days of this week.
It's fine. Don't worry. These are good questions. You should know these generally.
I feel like I should get an extra point just for taking part.
Nope. The refurbishment of Dubai International northern runway starts on Monday, May 9th and runs until... Any takers?
June.
I will accept it June 22nd, 45 days. Richard is on the board. Question number two. His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, Crown Prince of Dubai and Chairman of the Dubai Executive Council, announced that Vara has launched a headquarters in the metaverse, the Sandbox, the world's first regulator in the metaverse. What does Vara stand for? Richard was in before that.
Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority.
Correct. Richard is on the board again. Come on, Brandy. Right, question number three. The UAE is set to send an Emirati astronaut to the International Space Station next year, spring of 2023. When Hazar Mansouri, when he went to the International Space Station in 2019, he was there for 8 days. What is the duration of this new mission? Richard.
6 months.
All right, three. Right, next question.
I've been in another country.
It's okay. Question number four. Last year, the Dubai Police K9 unit helped limit the spread of COVID-19. During airport screenings, the dogs discovered 542 cases of the virus by sniffing what? Brandy?
Special cotton buds that have been up people's armpits.
Brandy's on the board. So Brandy 1, Richard 3. Question number 5. Name the cultural entertainment park or destination in Dubai that is set to close its doors. You've only got today and tomorrow. I can't tell if...
He was just twiddling.
Was he twiddling? Right, he was twiddling. Okay, Brandy.
You gave me a defective bell.
I have not given you a defect. Now you're blaming your tools. Brandy.
Don't make excuses for your performance,
defective
Richard.
Bell and defective tools. I can't win.
Brandy, what's the answer?
It is the Village of Global.
Correct. All right, Brandy 2, Richard 3. Question number 6. Central Bank UAE recently announced that ATMs will be distributing the new 5, 10 and 50 dirham notes. The new 5 dirham banknote is the same brown colour.
I wasn't here for this.
Listen, just listen.
Have you felt it and played with it yet?
Not that I'm aware of, but I might have just not noticed.
Have you played with one
yes,
yet?
Yes. I got a 50.
Yeah.
And this is the question. The 10 dirham note is still
Serena's
green.
Serena's fondled a 50.
I have. What colour is the 50 dirham note? And these images have been everywhere. Brandy?
Red. Ish.
That is incorrect.
Richard.
50's purple.
Correct.
Oh,
right. Okay, now you're just playing for pride, Brandy. Question number 7. When do you need to start paying for paid public parking again in Dubai and Abu Dhabi?
Oh!
Richard.
Bukhra, inshallah.
Sorry, Brandy, you were too late. Richard, it is tomorrow, Saturday, the 7th of May, and that means...
Let's celebrate
today's quiz. Now, your prize, and considering this is quite apt, you're going away, correct, after the show?
I've got my suitcase next to me, yeah.
Right, so what I have here is, and I've spared no expense, I have managed to procure, by going to visit many, many wonderful hotel establishments, these small little novelty items that you need when you're travelling, because you've only got carry-on, right?
Oh, is that by Rido?
So this is...
I'll have that one.
Wait, no, this is Richard's prize, not yours. So you've got a small bottle of body lotion. You have a dental kit. There's no shampoo, so I've given you a hairnet. Shower cap. You've got a deodorant and body wash. So you can take this with you.
Is it the tea tree body wash?
Yes, it is. Oh, so just be careful where you put that.
A bit tinkly, isn't it, that one?
So, so congratulations. You've won today's quiz, and this is your prize to take on your little trip away.
Thank you very much.
Which we don't get to go on.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking interest rates this morning, but today it's not the US that's in focus. It is the UK. The Bank of England has raised interest rates to 1%, a 13-year high. What does that mean for UAE interest in the UK property market? Very pleased to be joined now by Henry Fawn, head of the private office for Knight Frank Middle East. Henry, it's lovely to see you in the studio.
Brandy, Richard, it is a pleasure to see you in person too.
So this rate rise is not a surprise, but it is, you could say, unwelcome in some sectors. Will it have any effect on interest in the UK property market?
Great question there. As you mentioned, it is not a surprise for anyone looking at the UK property market or those holding real estate already in the UK. Now, in reality, what does it mean for those of us that perhaps have a mortgage in the UK or are looking at one? If we took an example of a £200,000 mortgage loan over a 25-year term, at the moment, on a variable rate, this current increase would mean about £25 per month more coming out of your pocket. Now, in reality, will that affect house prices in the UK or our interest here from the Middle East, perhaps the UK? Potentially not, but it is certainly something to consider in the UK as a wider cost of living.
And it's also seen, I think, as being the thin edge of the wedge. I mean, if we take away the numbers and just look at the rhetoric coming out from the Bank of England yesterday, they were talking about potential 10% inflation. They were talking about a potential recession. They were talking about the high cost of everything, but particularly energy, which would signal that more rate rises are to come.
Correct, both in the UK, perhaps in the US as well, and therefore locally here.
How high would interest rates have to get before they really started putting off buyers?
Good question, Brandy. The reality is that most of our buyers these days aren't necessarily taking the variable rate loans. Most of our buyers tend to take a 5 or 10 year fixed term, and perhaps they can then roll over a new fixed term after that. And therefore, the shocks in terms of increasing rates on a monthly or quarterly basis affect them a little less.
Rich and I had lunch yesterday in your neighbourhood, which also happens to be my neighbourhood, and we discussed the weighing up that a lot of expats do. Do you buy at home? Do you buy in your adopted home? Do you buy where you think you might end up? Do interest rate rises in any countries actually affect that decision?
They certainly would do. The reality is, if we were weighing up the options of buying here locally in Dubai versus perhaps renting for that foreseeable future, it will be a good calculation to calculate your forecast payments in terms of your rent versus those mortgage payments as well. And we could do the same calculation for the UK for an investment.
Talk to me about what's actually happening in the UK property market at the moment. We saw a bit of a hollowing out in cities around the world, and London no exception, in terms of where people wanted to live amid lockdowns. Where are we with that?
In the past 18 months, we've seen a race to greener areas. And by that, I mean from the central cities, London, for example, people have raced to the outer areas where they can perhaps afford for the same money a house with a garden and perhaps another home office there as well. What we're now seeing in the past few months is a more recent trend. We're calling that boomerang effect, where those buyers and perhaps renters have gone out to the home counties and are now coming back into central London as the lockdown measures have been lifted.
What does that mean for prices?
Rents have actually trickled up a little bit first, and we're forecasting prime central London prices to continue as well. The prices in London have actually increased to May this year 2% or so, and we're forecasting 3.5% total for 2022.
And what does that mean for the attractiveness for people from here? Prices going up, but also potentially maybe your yields if you're a landlord.
Correct. Over the coming 5 years is probably a good window to start with. I would suggest that most buy-to-let investors looking at London, for example, take a 10 or 12 plus year window on those properties. The reality is that if we can get a growth of around 22%, which we forecast in central London over the coming 5 years, and rents potentially to increase by 17% on their current rate, then actually capital growth and yield is looking quite positive for now.
That's a hefty increase, 17%, given the cost of living crisis that the Bank of England was talking about yesterday. Is that sustainable?
It's actually due to a lack of supply, Brandy. There's a few things that are contributing to all of this. So we've got the lack of supply. So both people are not putting their houses on the market to sell or rent, and house builders are not necessarily handing over the same volumes. We've got lower cost of borrowing, which has been at record low levels for a number of years. We've actually got that flight to green space. And also we've got the accumulated wealth. So many have actually been at home in the past couple of years, not travelling, not buying items or spending it on holidays. And that has actually also affected the new purchases and renting.
Are we not potentially moving into a situation, though, where a lot of people can't afford? I mean, we were already talking about, you know, a generation of people, of millennials, who might never own a home. But if we see that cost of living increase, if we see inflation increase, is it going to price more people out of the market?
I would suggest in some areas, for example, if we took the most central areas in the middle of London, many of us cannot afford to live there anyway. And if things do change by, you know, £25 per month on our mortgage, we still will not be able to afford to live there. Where most do tend to live is on the outer areas of London, which can be a bit more affordable. Or we can move to other areas as well, which are still commutable to your work.
OK, so you're British. It's your home market. How attractive is it remaining for those for whom it's not? Because we're not being British-centric here on the Business Breakfast. London, the UK in general, has always been a big draw for money from this region, regardless of passport.
Correct. The ease of travel, language, education and lifestyle factors in the UK are all the full package that it offers in terms of owning a property there. There are other cities as well that certainly those from the region here, I wouldn't just necessarily pick the UAE, but wider region tend to look at as well as a second home, perhaps France or Spain or even over towards the US.
So before we let you go, Henry, how high do you expect interest rates in the UK to go? What's your outlook?
I couldn't possibly say for now, but we'll see how inflation goes. The forecast for the end of this year for inflation is around about 7%. So if that comes down a little bit to the bank's target 2.0, we'll see how interest rates track that.
Well, the official language coming out of the UK is that some degree of further tightening in monetary policy might still be appropriate in the coming months. So watch this space. Henry Fawn, head of the private office for Knight Frank Middle East, thank you very much for joining us on the Business Breakfast this morning.
Thank you very much, Brandy.
Rich, you're about to hop on a plane to go to the UK. You are a property owner in Slough, known
yes.
for its entertainment, weather, fine buildings and general natural beauty.
Yeah, I owned a cheap little rental apartment in a place called Slough, which is about 25 miles from Big Ben, or I'd say 35 kilometres from Big Ben. It's fine. It does okay.
The last time I was in Slough, I watched the same movie twice, back to back. I'm just going to point that out.
Okay. I don't know. I bought this off. I've never seen it. Never set foot in it. Bought it about 6 years ago. It's been a bit of a disaster as an investment, if I'm perfectly honest, for various reasons to do with safety and flammable panels on the outside of it. But there you go. Some you win, some you lose.
So how did the Bank of England's comments yesterday, and I mean, you don't have an English mortgage on that one, you've got one from here, but how does it make you feel about investment into the UK as a whole?
So UK real estate is very, very expensive at the moment. So it's not particularly appealing. However, the currency is very, very cheap at the moment. So buying sterling is really, really cheap. So you've got to weigh those two up. Prices of real estate very expensive, but the currency is very, very low. But again, I might be more tempted to look at the apart from that, the investment I have in the UK is not the FTSE 100 index, which is the one that media like us quote, for two reasons. Firstly, there's very few UK companies on that. And secondly, it's described as a 19th century index because there's lots of 19th century industries like mining that are listed on the FTSE 100. However, the FTSE 250 is much more of a British index and has far more technology type companies on it. So that's where I'm tempted given low sterling.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
And that expert this morning is Matt Stanley. The OPEC Plus group is sticking to its modest output rise for yet another month. That is despite a potential European ban on Russian crude and rising prices. Rich and I can't figure out whether it's the most boring OPEC meeting in history or indeed one of the most important. So we're putting that question this morning to the Star Fuels senior broker, Matt Stanley. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, guys. Morning. Welcome back, Brandy.
Thank you very much. Paint a picture for us. What's the background to this OPEC meeting? What did they have to weigh up?
Well, I mean, you say was this one boring? I think the last five have been boring, but it depends your definition of boredom because there's not a lot the group can do. I mean, Amina, you had on yesterday, there isn't enough spare capacity. They can't just increase production. They're struggling to meet what they're supposed to be producing right now. The group is consistent of Russia, OPEC Plus, and the OPEC's... The objective of OPEC is to manage oil markets. And if they were to sway from one side or the other, looking at what they need to balance, which is supply and demand, the issues about supply from Russia is one side of the coin, and then demand faltering in the rest of the world from COVID with China is the other side. So if they increased or decreased production, the market would take that as, that really would put the aggression into the market to go one way or the other. So they had no choice really but to do nothing, just to maintain course.
But we are hearing from OPEC, as we always do, that they're also there to sort of stabilise the market. We've got oil at $110 a barrel. We've got runaway inflation almost everywhere across the globe. How is not adding more oil stable?
Well, I agree with you. It depends. It depends what is fair value for crude oil right now. And if you look at what JP Morgan came out with yesterday, they said they are concerned about demand. With China, with the lockdowns, they've got to decrease their demand forecast by 1 million barrels a day, which is 400,000 barrels less than pre-pandemic. But they were increasing their oil price outlook. There is one equation at the moment that the market is looking at and global markets in general, and that is an energy crisis, that there simply will not be enough oil at the end of the year. OPEC, there is only so much they can do. Even if the GCC core can increase production, they can pick up some slack, it's not enough to compensate for losses that people are looking at. So 110, I told you a few weeks ago, I think could look cheap in the summer.
If demand is falling, why isn't there going to be enough oil? Is it just that Russian oil that no one can or will buy?
That's a good question because it's the logistics around where the oil is. So if you look at why oil premiums on physical cargoes are faltering in China because they simply don't need the oil right now because most of them are locked down. Whereas if you look in, say, Germany, there's a refinery in eastern Germany which is half owned by Rosneft, which is the Russian state oil company, a little bit by the Italians, and the other half by Shell, UK company. And because of the sanctions in the EU, Shell have been told to cease any business with Russia. So Rosneft has obviously got to go. And it's not just where those companies are based. It's where those companies are getting their oil from. So the majority of Russia, especially the eastern Russia, especially eastern Germany, all of those refineries are fed from a pipeline from Russia. It's called the Friendly Pipeline. The irony is not lost on me. And you simply can't replace those barrels. They all come from Russia. It's via pipeline. You'd have to then pipe barrels in from Poland, and it simply wouldn't work economically. So majority of those refineries will shut down and that will increase oil prices purely down to the logistics of how those refineries are being fed crude oil in the first place.
Talk to me then, since you brought up Germany, about these potential EU sanctions. Mm. We've got a bit of holdout from people like Hungary, who are worried about what no pipeline energy could mean for the populations. Is it likely to happen, do you think? What are your customers factoring in? What could it mean for Europe?
Well, there's a few things there. Germany is obviously front and centre and is being used as the case study because they're the biggest economy in Europe. They can't go down the likes of the UK and the US because they've got to think about the other 27 members of the bloc that are within the EU. There will be some fighting, right, for want of a better term. Hungary, Slovakia, Czech Republic, these are landlocked countries. Like I said, the whole energy infrastructure is based on feedstock from Russia. You can't replace that overnight. You can't just drape a pipeline over the Alps and think that you can get crude fed in different ways. It's not that easy. So there will be some resistance there. However, when the EU came out with potential sanctions on Tuesday, I think it was, the biggest one for me wasn't that the EU's going to follow their diet away from Russian oil. Of course, that's inevitable with what's going on. It's right now they're going to stop insurance companies, shipping companies from doing any business in Europe. That will really drive sooner rather than later, because it's being kicked down the road, you know, when they had to stop those supplies. There will be some, I'd imagine, some caveats in the agreement that certain countries may have a waiver. Ultimately, oil is going to have to come in from other parts of the world, and it will get more expensive, and it only just adds to the inflation argument. So I'm pretty sure that there'll need to be some kind of subsidy scheme that's set up, which is why this is taking time, before you really see a boxing of Russian oil.
How much more expensive? I mean, we had the Bank of England last night warning of potential 10% inflation in the UK, and they were pointing very much to energy prices.
Look, I totally agree. It's a good point, but demand for diesel and petrol in the UK went up 10% in April. So I think that there is, what are you going to do? You're not just going to stay at home, buy a bike like Greta and only travel around 10 miles around your house. You're still going to drive. It just means that perhaps other parts of your expenditure, wouldn't get there. But energy is easily, in my view, is in danger. Crude is in danger in the summer of getting to 150, and gases could double from here. There simply isn't enough. Without Russian molecules into Europe, there simply is not enough energy in Europe.
What does 150 do to demand?
Well, I think that it doesn't increase it. Right, let's say demand drops by, say, 10% on the back of high prices. Even at 90%, there still will not be enough energy to supply that 90%, so prices will still go any one way. Because 50% of the EU's diesel came from Russia. You can't just replace that from the likes of a Reliance in India, from an Aramco in the Red Sea, or from the US Gulf Coast, which seem to be the real winners at the moment. Because that flow, it's a change in trade flows, Brandy. It's no longer Russia to Europe, it will be Gulf Coast, instead of selling, say, into China because demand is faltering, they will move that flow into Europe, and they're the winners at the moment.
30 seconds. What's your price outlook then? Where are we going, short to medium?
I think it depends. You take Shell's results yesterday, they announced a $9 billion, which are extraordinary. That is down purely to one reason, and it's rising what we call crack margins, the refining margin, the difference between when you put a barrel of crude into a refinery and you get a barrel of diesel out. They're about $45. I think that diesel could certainly get above $1,500 a ton by July, because a lot of these contracts, by end of Q2, they're really going to finish. The traders are really going to finish those contracts. So in the summer, July, August, September, is when we really see that spike in oil. $1,500 diesel, $150 crude is not out of the realms of possibility.
20 seconds, what does it mean for us?
Well, look here, fiscal budgets are based on high oil prices. It's only a good thing. Whether it's a good thing is a moral question, but look, we'll only reap the benefits of Europe pulling demand from this region specifically, and it will stay that way for the foreseeable future.
Matt Stanley, Starfield's senior broker, $150 a barrel by July.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Talking staycations now and vacation economics booming over the Eid al-Fitr weekend, but what happens next? Joined on the line and indeed on Microsoft Teams by Tim Cordon, who's the Area Senior Vice President for the Middle East and also Africa at the Radisson Hotel Group. Tim, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Richard. Good to be back.
So, anecdotally, we hear that staycations here in the UAE booming during the Eid al-Fitr break. What did you see?
Absolutely. I mean, it caps off what's been a fantastic Q4 in the UAE and also Q1 of this year, Q1 this year, where we've seen numbers far in excess of what we originally expected, actually. So it's great news. The recovery's bounced back more quickly than we anticipated. And specifically over Eid, up to 30% better than a similar period in 2019, which is, of course, the historical benchmark. So yeah, very happy with the level of demand we've seen.
So 30% up on 2019, that's great. Let's talk numbers. Let's talk things like occupancy rates, or let's talk about room rates, or RevPAR. Pick a metric, Tim. What can you tell us?
I mean, the Middle East generally over the last 6 months has had an average rate somewhere around 20 to 30% better than 2019. There's a number of factors there. I mean, Dubai, we've been able to celebrate having the Expo, which has been a huge contributor. But there are many, many other things as well that have played into it. So Eid is not... Whilst it's been very successful, it's not a standalone bright spot. It's a continuation of what we've seen for the last 6 months. And that is purely caused by the global demand. So there's this enormous pent-up demand for travel and tourism that we're seeing in this, let's call it post-pandemic world. And Dubai particularly has done extremely well with that. I mean, I'd go so far as to say that over the last couple of years, if you have a hotel, I mean, Dubai is one of the best places in the world you could possibly have had one.
How's the rest of the region done? And we'll talk about the Middle East in particular and the key markets like Saudi Arabia as well for you.
Yeah, I mean, the UAE is leading the way. I don't think there's any question about that. And specifically Dubai, it's had the best, most robust performance. And I already mentioned the Expo, and there are other reasons why Dubai's done so well. But Saudi's also bouncing back very strongly. Kuwait has lagged a little bit. It's been a little bit slower, and they've had a slightly more conservative policy towards COVID-19. And that's caused that. But I'm glad to see it's rebounding very strongly now. And I think the only thing that's really holding us back from what I'd call a full market recovery is group business, or business group business, I should say. There's plenty of leisure group business around, but we don't see a full return yet of those kind of business and incentive groups and conferences. It's coming, and the inquiries look good. And I think by the end of this year, we should see that recovery too.
Well, business travel more generally, we know that leisure has led the recovery in the travel industry over the past couple of years or so. Are we seeing those business trips now, people flying in from India, Pakistan, people flying in from Nigeria, coming into places like business centres like Riyadh or Abu Dhabi, or as you mentioned, Kuwait City?
Yeah, I think absolutely we are. I think... you know, the numbers from the airport and Emirates bear that out, that it's that they've seen some incredible demand as well. And I think that's come back more quickly than we expected. And I can speak from my own personal experience that I was on a plane every single week in April and all business trips. So it's great to get back out there, actually, and see everybody and visit the hotels and understand what's happening in the markets.
So what would be the occupancy rate at one of your business hotels in Dubai, I don't know, last night or tonight? I mean, you probably don't have the exact data on your fingertips, but in terms of ballpark terms, I'm thinking of, you know, one of your big business hotels here in Dubai.
Well, right now, we're post-Eid. We've just come out of Ramadan, which is traditionally a slower trading period for business hotels anyway. And now we're going into a lower season over the summer here where temperatures become a bit less hospitable. So we're not seeing the absolutely full that we've seen for quite a period, but we're still very, very respectable. And we're talking high 70s, low 80s in the occupancy percentage, that kind of thing.
Which is not too shabby, is it?
No, not at all.
So what happens next in terms of your pipeline and what you're building when you look to the medium and long term?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that leisure led the way. And I think, you know, there was a time where investing in resorts was a kind of an investment of last resort. And that's not the case at all anymore. There's a rush to invest in resort hotels and expand the leisure portfolio. And of course, we're keen to do that too. So we've opened our first resort in Ras Al Khaimah at the end of last year. It's done exceptionally well. And I think we'll see more of that to come. We also have a very strong pipeline in Saudi Arabia, where we expect to have over 50 hotels operational in the next couple of years.
In terms of Saudi Arabia, how do you approach, as a hotelier with a major international chain, and what kind of conversations are you having with head office about these giga projects there, things like the Red Sea or NEOM or Al Ula, whatever it may be? When you're talking with your board and you're saying, this is happening, it's really exciting, what kind of questions are they asking? And are you pushing the button on these areas yet?
We are. I think you have to go to Saudi and you have to meet with the ministry. You have to sit with the Tourism Development Fund or PIF or whoever it is and understand what the business plan is. And we've done that. And it's incredibly impressive. The business plan they have for those destinations is something that is extremely professional, well thought out, sensible KPIs. And frankly, in the region, from a government point of view, I haven't seen that outside of the UAE before. So I think that gives us some, gives the projects at least a lot of credibility, and it gives us some reason to be very positive that these projects are going to come off and they're going to work out well, and that there's a lot of opportunity there.
Tim, great talking to you as ever. Appreciate your time this morning and your candid honesty. That's the area Senior Vice President for the Middle East and Africa. We didn't even get on to Africa, so that will be the next conversation, Tim. Tim Corden from Radisson Hotel Group.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.